Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are two people who in very different ways blazed a trail in the 1950s, a decade which was blighted by economic depression, unemployment and emigration. Ronnie Delaney gave the country a huge boost when he brought home an Olympic gold in the 1500 metres. And in the same year, Maeve Kyle became our first female Olympic athlete. They both competed in the 1956 Olympic Games in Melbourne and have been close friends ever since. You're both very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Had you met each other, did you know of each other before you headed off to Melbourne in 1956?
Well, I did because I live with a track statistician who knew everybody and I knew who Ronnie was.
And I knew Maeve because my brother Joe would have known you better, but I knew her as the hockey international. And Maeve has 50 caps for Ireland as a hockey player. And I was interested in hockey, so I knew her teammates, Joe O'Reilly, Anita Doherty. And extraordinarily, the Irish hockey team were in Melbourne, in the stadium, the day I won my race.
I actually should have gone out with them, but I had a small child and they were going by boat and coming back by boat, so I thought it would probably take about a year to get the whole thing in.
Two children.
And I was actually the captain of that team and I turned it down because I just couldn't bear to be away from them. I couldn't do it. It just was impossible. And the wee one she was going to have her second birthday when I was away.
Little Shauna.
And how did you then end up going as an athlete to the Olympics, Maeve?
I have no idea. I'm quite genuine.
Maeve, I think, underplays her athletic accomplishments in every field. She was a very good runner at the time and rightly earned her selection.
But I've never had the opportunity to compete, really.
Yeah, yeah. You know. But you're still a great athlete.
And Ronnie, when you headed out to Melbourne that time with Maeve, what was it like? Did you know what you were both heading into?
I had gone to America at 19 years of age under the scholarship system. So I had superb coaching and superb preparation. Therefore, I didn't go from Ireland. I left from New York to go down to Melbourne. The team had come in from Shannon into New York. I think it was on TWA. And I met them on a half-lit aeroplane and we're going to fly on to San Francisco where we got to know each other very
well.
That's
right. Yeah.
What a great experience. And you were 21, Ronnie, and you were 28,
yes,
Maeve.
Yeah.
Wasn't there, though, a quaint letter in the Irish Times?
Yes, right.
You have it in front of you there. Do you mind reading it for me, Maeve?
For the slightest.
What year was this now we're talking
1956.
About? 1956.
Irish team for Olympics, sir. There wasn't a woman editor in those days. Last week, the Irish Olympic Council met to select a team to compete in the Olympic Games at Melbourne next month. When I read the selected list of competitors, I found it contained the name of a woman, a married woman. I deplore it. A sports field or arena is no place for a woman and certainly not a missus. It is most unbecoming, unseemly and degrading of women folk. It must not be countenanced on any grounds. Pope Pius XI, emphasising the rules for separation of the sexes, which the law of nature and Christian prudence demand, has declared these rules must be observed also in athletics and gymnastic exercises, where special precautions must be taken in regard to Christian modesty in the case of girls, inasmuch as it is extremely unbecoming for them to display themselves before the public gaze.
Wow.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's absolutely wonderful.
Did anyone show you that letter at the time?
Oh, yes, I saw it. My mother thought it was hilarious, but then my mother was like that. My mother-in-law was absolutely horrified. I'd been mentioned in the paper and in such terms. So sometimes I'm referred to as the suffragette of athletics. And I will say they didn't throw me under a carriage, but probably there were people who would have liked to. But it was very strongly disapproved of. I think we forget now that Ireland was a seriously conservative country in those days. And I refused to accept that it was totally the church was against it. It wasn't. I had more opposition from the older women in society, including those around the north of Ireland where I lived at the time. I was a married woman. I was deserting my husband and my daughter and leaving them. And I was trying to explain, well, I actually didn't think of this. It was my husband who got me training and he was my coach.
And is it true even there would have been concern about the kind of clothes you would have worn, whether you were an athlete or a hockey player?
Well, as a hockey player, there was no flesh allowed to be seen. So we wore long black stockings with suspenders, probably very sexy to those that watched. But they were a damn nuisance, put it mildly. But we had to wear them. We wore tunics, quite heavy tunics, especially if they got wet. And we wore long-sleeved blouses. So the only thing that was visible were our faces. And
Ronnie's laughing. Do you remember that?
It's hard to believe.
Well, I remember another side as well, because there was a great athletics promoter at the time, Billy Morton.
That's right.
And post the Olympic Games in 48, a lot of the Olympic athletes came to Dublin, including Fanny Blanker's call.
To Lansdowne Road.
To Lansdowne Road. And in the sacred turf of rugby, Billy put on these meetings. But Fanny Blanker's was probably the greatest female Olympian track athlete of all time. Would you agree?
I would, yes, absolutely. And she was also a housewife with a young family. Yeah. So that was very, for women who were trying to get into sport, it was very important. She was a role model who, for those of us who are in a similar situation, she was obviously able to balance her domestic life with her athletic life and be hugely successful as she was. I mean, she won medals at all sorts of events.
And she was phenomenally successful in her life
she
as
was,
well.
She was, yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And is it true when you arrived in Melbourne that there were a lot of people there to greet you, which turned out to be almost sad in the end, mate?
Yeah, well, I didn't discover, and there were thousands of people at the airport, and we couldn't understand it because it was the middle of the night to start with, or late evening.
This wasn't in Sydney, this was in Melbourne.
Where the games were going
to be.
And there were thousands of people at the airport, and the airports were, they were all rushing around the plane. We were getting out and they were putting us into
Yeah, I mean, they were out on the tarmac.
Yeah. And they were giving me flowers and they were shaking you by the hand out the bus window, and there's a picture of that somewhere.
Well,
but what I discovered in 2000, and when did I go out to the Commonwealths in Melbourne?
2006, was it?
In 2006, I took young Anna Boyle out, she was running, and they asked me to speak on a radio show, and I mentioned this, and the phone started to ring, apparently, and I was told that they were the children who had been sent out from the British Isles, Ireland and UK, at the time, because the parents really couldn't afford to raise them, and many of them didn't really know who their families were. They were too young. Yeah. And I found that's a memory I'll never forget. Mm. And those people, we were actually the first contact since the late 1930s that those people had with Ireland as a country. We were carrying tricolours and all the rest of it, flags, and we were wearing green. It was
an extraordinary time because I left Ireland on the 23rd of September 1954 to go to America. You couldn't leave from Dublin. There was no transatlantic runway at Dublin. I left from Shannon. And they were waking all of the people from the west of Ireland. And there was keening and there was music. And I getting on that plane, I never knew if I'd get back to Ireland. Now, I was successful as an athlete.
There's still emigration.
I was back within a year. But your mindset was, I'm leaving Ireland forever.
In other words, it was so sad, that type of emigration in particular.
It's tragic. Like, I mean, I think they used to wake them out of the village and then someone would go to the airport.
Because they never came back a lot of the time, wasn't
it? Well, what saddened me so much about the people in Melbourne was that they had gone out as children, some of them only 8 and 9 years of age.
But Melbourne was much further as well. In the 60s, I was working for Aer Lingus in New York in 1960. And at that stage, the Irish were becoming more wealthy. Mm-hmm. And the charter planes were introduced by Aer Lingus. And all of these Irish societies used to charter a plane and come home for the summer. And there was a playwright called John Murphy, and he wrote a play called The Country Boy. I remember because he was from Ireland, and it was the only play he ever wrote. But this is the story of an emigrant coming home. And the pathos of it was that he came home, he was pretending he was successful in America, he had a camera and he had a big case, there was nothing in the camera. He was just a poor Irishman who managed to scrape a trip home. Fascinating times. Mm-hmm.
But look, to focus on the Olympics, because, Ronnie, everyone talks about your great gold win. When you ran the race, did you think you'd win?
Yes, absolutely. I mean,
he thought about it long before we ever got to Australia.
Yeah. Well, see, I was under the American system. I also was extraordinarily gifted. I don't mean to be immodest, but one can't talk about oneself without appearing to be immodest.
Were you always a fast runner, as a little boy?
At 17 years of age, I only began to run.
Really?
And I was a schoolboy champion. I was a tennis player. I had 2 Leinster Cup medals for tennis. And I was invited to run against the Northern Ireland Amateur Athletic Association. And I ran my first men's race in August 1953. And I was the first Irish youth to break 2 minutes for a half mile. 2 minutes. Now, the next year, Bannister ran a mile in under 4 minutes. So I was a two-minute half mile. But then when I did that, I knew, yeah, I have some talent. And I had the instinct and, I suppose, the inspiration to chase my dream. And I took all the correct decisions subsequently. And by 19, I was a really good athlete. I worked out at Kilkenny, your dad's school. And when I was in Kilkenny, I trained very rigorously. And the first race I ran since doing the half mile under 2 minutes, I broke the Irish record for the half mile and I was on my way. And I was a great athlete within a year of that.
I think it should never be forgotten too that sport in our time was our main social outlet, because it was the one that cost the least money for most families. You took part in sport, and that's where you met your friends and you made your friends. Mm. And it was for you, it was a gateway to education, to everything in the States.
Yeah, well, that was the American scholarship system.
That was the American scholarship
system.
That's
a Villanova.
Yeah,
yep.
You were getting a combination.
Yes.
I already had a cadetship to the Irish Army, and the key decisions I had to take, one of them was to leave the Irish Army with great regret, because they would make me a good officer, but I couldn't be an athlete there, and I discovered this. So this caused chaos in my home. And the next decision I had to take was I could try and get a scholarship to America, and I got that within 9 months of that, and you're on your way.
And you mentioned there, Meg, that he trained in your father's school. Explain that to me.
Ronnie, probably I wasn't there at the time.
Well,
I don't know where I was.
Yeah.
I was living in Ballymena, I suppose, at that time.
Yeah,
Daddy
see,
was always, my parents were very enthusiastic about sport and supported it.
Kilkenny School was the only school that had a grass track. Now, it wasn't even a quarter mile. It was about 300 yards. Mm-hmm. And I politely approached the school. And through May's father, I was allowed to train on this track.
Because he was the headmaster, was he?
Yes, he was. He was a man way ahead of his times, because there was a covered ball alley in the school and he invited the local very good handballers that were there. So, of course, as kids, we used to stand out early in the morning and wait for the postman to come, who was a champion handballer, and we would get a small game in the alley. And I reckon that was one of the things that gave me the good eye-hand coordination that helped me in hockey. Yeah. And then we ran a seven-a-side, the school ran a seven-a-side hockey tournament at Easter. It was a great hockey school. Yeah. And this team won it 2 or 3 years in a row. And this was a time when GAA and hockey didn't mix. We discovered, Daddy knew, he discovered they were the local GAA, the local hurling team. There were seven of them and they decided to go in and they won the
blinking
thing.
They probably played under false
names. Yeah, well, we did. Nobody officially knew who they were and nobody ever said. It was kept as a very much a closed bit of information. But I mean, that was the sort of school it was. It was he'd insisted on very good tennis courts and a very good track. It was a nice track. And down by the river, he cleared the pool under the weir so the boys and the children could swim in the River Nor, and we did all the time.
Well, look, we're going to take a listen now, Ronnie, to your great win in 1956.
Thank you.
I'll ask you afterwards about when that moment that you won, but let's listen now just to the very end of your win.
Thank you.
180 yards to go. Houston's got his head back, but he's well in the lead. Richardson is there, and Landy is moving up. And Delaney coming up for Era on the outside. Houston, has he gone a bit too soon? Delaney coming up very fast. Into the straight they go, and Houston is holding on. And Delaney is up with him. And the German Richardson is there. And Delaney is going to win for Era. And up comes Landy. And Houston is beaten. And Delaney is going to win. And Richardson is second, and Landy both. So Era wins. From Richardson Heights and Landing, and either Torbury or Houston, fourth or fifth.
Does it bring back incredible memories even now?
Yeah, it's beautiful memory. And the fun of it, the English commentator was so aghast at the Irishman coming up. He always said, oh, geez, an Irishman has come up.
Rex Alston, apparently, was his name, because I suppose in 1956, RTE didn't cover the Olympics.
No, and the funny thing, it wasn't even, RTE didn't open until maybe 7 or 8 in the morning, 7:30. But the commentator said, watch the athlete from Ireland. or era,
era
he probably
as they called us.
Yeah. Yes, I knew. I said, Ronnie's on the straight. No, Ronnie's going to win. There's no alternative. That's it. Mm-hmm.
The race was held maybe 3 hours earlier, but they didn't broadcast it. And theoretically it was broadcast live. And everyone tells me they got up out of bed and they heard. So I have lovely, happy memories of that.
But, you know, Australia had no television at the time. So I didn't see the race until I came home and watched it on one of the Pathé News. That's exactly right. So we'd been there and watched it, but we couldn't tell anybody. You know, we were so excited.
But
we
in a funny way, like that's why the legend of Ronnie Delaney has lived on, because it wasn't on television. Mm-hmm. And the generations who were listening to me, they had to imagine what I was doing. And then it was enhanced by Pathé News. Mm-hmm. And when I went to the theatre when I came home that Christmas, the Pathé News would show the race and everyone would jump up. Yeah. Listen, so much fun.
And at the end of the race, did you fall to your knees and say a prayer?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what prayer did you say?
I don't know. I had a very close sense of my religion, my relationship with a greater being. So I used to pray before races, and I didn't pray for victory. I always prayed for the ability to run to the best of my ability. And I was sort of cheating a bit because I knew if you let me do that, I would win. The first thought, when you win, you come through the tape, and the picture people see now is a film of it, of the race. Mm-hmm. You come to it and you can't believe you've won. You say, oh, my God, I've won. And you break into this extraordinary smile. And then you go over to the side of the track and instinctively I said a prayer. And I said a prayer of thanksgiving. Now, what I said, I just said, probably, dear God, thank you. Thank you for my gift. Thank you for enabling me to do this. But I became the most popular Irishman ever to visit Australia, because every priest trying to sell to the missionaries and every priest in Australia, I think, had to contact me, had to say, come to our parish. I was sick and tired of priests by about a week later.
And when you stood on the podium to get your medal,
was that
a special moment?
Yeah. There was an issue over ERA Ireland, and I still remember Avery Brundage, who was the president of the International Olympic Committee, and I remember Lord Killallen having gone to bat saying, we were Ireland, and the fact of Maeve from the north of Ireland, me from the south of Ireland, but we were Ireland. And when he presented me with my medal, he said, I present this to you, Ronnie Delaney of Ireland. And I remember that to this day. Extraordinary thing for him to say.
It was a huge high for everybody, because suddenly Ireland was recognised as a country who could compete with the best in the world and win. And I think that had a... No, that's true. And I think that had an enormous effect on Irish people. I think Irish people still in the 1950s were... It wasn't they were under a yoke, but they felt as if they were, that they didn't have the right to be themselves. Mm. In literature and in some of the arts, certainly individual Irish people did. But as a race, I don't think we...
Lack confidence,
I think
maybe.
We lack confidence. Yeah. We lack the confidence,
Miriam, I think Maeve and I would be in serious trouble if we didn't mention our teammates, because, believe
Absolutely.
It or not, in that Olympic Games, we won 5 medals. Fred Teith won a silver medal in the boxing. Johnny Caldwell,
Freddie Gilroy,
and Tony Soxburn won bronze medals.
So and, Jerry Martino
was
fourth.
He was fourth. Mm-hmm. What an extraordinary team. We had no manager, we had no doctor, we had no trainer.
Maybe there's a moral in there.
I think you'll be picked up on that.
I don't care. Maeve, you ran in the 100 and the 200 metres, didn't you?
Yep.
You didn't get a medal, but
no,
you did very well.
I did all right, but I wasn't fast enough. But that was the only events there were for women on the track. There was nothing above 200 metres, because women obviously weren't strong enough to do that sort of thing.
Do you think a higher metre race would have suited you better?
I didn't. It was the same in Rome, and it was all right. I did all right, but I was totally dissatisfied and felt I'd let everybody down. And I hadn't really, but that's what you think at the time. I would love to have been higher up. I really just wanted to get through a round, and that would have proved that I was good enough to be sent. But when it came to Tokyo, I'd done the qualifying times, I don't know how many times.
Was that 1964?
64.
Yeah.
So when I was selected and I had beaten already the girls who are being touted as finalists, I knew I could stand a chance and I should have been in the final. I think it was overcompeted at the time. It was just a little late in the year. But I did well enough, you know.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take your first piece of music you both like, isn't it? It's a song written by Brendan O'Reilly called Let the Nations Play. Tell me about it, Ron.
If I may.
Yeah, of course.
Brendan was a dear, dear friend of ours, but he should have been an Olympian with us. He was actually selected, but they gave him notification of his selection too late, and he couldn't raise the amount of money. We had to raise money ourselves.
We had to raise £200.
The budget for the government spent £3,000 on sending that Olympic team, and Brendan didn't make it to the Olympics.
Because £200 would have been a lot of money.
Oh, huge amount of money.
Our house the year before had cost £2,000.
Yeah. Right, so a tenth.
Tenth of the value
but Brendan
of your house.
was selected, his name appeared in the programme, and then he went on to this great career in
That's so sad,
Radio
though, just because of money he couldn't
terrible.
Go to
well, there
the
was
Olympics.
A degree of politics to it as well, which I wouldn't go into and which I didn't know about at the time, but there was a degree of politics. But the beauty of it is that he wrote this anthem at a time when there was trouble in the Olympics. You know, there were boycotts, the Americans and the Africans. And he wrote this beautiful anthem, the words of which I think are relevant, very relevant to this day. And it's our way of saying to a fellow Olympian, even though he wasn't in Australia, Brendan, we think of you. We think of you warmly.
Oh, that's lovely. And we're going to listen now to Brendan O'Reilly's song, Let the Nations Play, and it's sung by Laurie Spee.
Let the nations play. Let the athletes of the world run free.
Laurie Spee there singing Let the Nations Play, a song written by a good friend of yours, Brendan O'Reilly. When you came back from those Olympics, you came back, Maiden, there was a great reception. I know you came back later on, Ronnie,
yes.
But was there a wonderful reception at Shannon?
We landed in a chair, absolutely fabulous, but the reception was the whole way to Dublin. I think it took, instead of taking 4 hours or something, it took about 8 hours to actually get to Dublin. And I still have a lovely little plaque that Mrs. Tisdale, Bob Tisdale's mum, came and presented us with. And I still have it. It's just perfect.
And why didn't you come back with them, Ronnie? You, the gold medal hero.
Yeah, well, I went out to college in September. And I left early November to go down to the Olympic Games. I was taking leave of absence from college.
This is the American college,
Villanova University. Yeah. And I'd done all my midterm exams and I'd done extremely well in them. So when I went to go to the Olympics, I wanted to come home and go back to college. Otherwise, I would have lost 6 months of my life. I wouldn't have, I'd have had to take one semester off. So I went back to America and my teammates went back to all this glorious reception in Ireland.
You missed all that, Dory.
I didn't really, because when I arrived at Shannon just before Christmas, the
same thing happened.
Great reception was there. And like Maeve, I came up through Ireland and they met the Tizzle. Bob Tizzle was from Nina and he was an Olympic champion in 1932. And his parents greeted me. And every town you went into, I was a single athlete in an open car. And everywhere I went, the reminiscences would happen and the speeches were made by the chairman of the local council. And then some guy with a few jars and we go up, Mickey Joe down the road, if he trained as hard as Delaney, he'd have beaten Delaney. Every town I went in, there was always some guy, the guy who never made it for some reason or other. And I used to find this so amusing and so entertaining for me.
But it was also a sharing an identity with you that people believed. Now it was possible for Irish people to succeed.
To win gold.
That's a very generous comment. But then we did have a great reception as a team. Mm-hmm. The President of Ireland met us. We were up in the park. Mm-hmm. We were greeted by the Taoiseach at the time was Eamon de Valera.
And the Lord Mayor of
Dublin, Briscoe. Mm-hmm. That was great because he was the Lord Mayor. And so anyway.
The amazing thing about you, Maeve, though, is it true that you were pregnant? You discovered something that you were pregnant when you competed at Melbourne. Just a teeny bit.
I always tease Sean and say that was your parting present. But I was pregnant, but literally I was only just pregnant. I didn't even know. And then I discovered when I came home about Christmas time that I thought I was putting on weight. And apparently I was pregnant. I said, I told the doctor I didn't believe it, but he said, oh, it's happened before, you know. I was terrified anyone would think I'd got pregnant out in Melbourne, but it wasn't.
And then, sadly, that baby.
We lost that little boy when he was about 3 months old.
That's tragic.
He was the only boy in Sean's side of the family. A gorgeous baby, but that was life. And I was glad to have him. Sean took it very hard.
What was his name?
Michael John.
And how old was he when he died?
He was about 3 months. Yeah.
And what happened, Maeve?
Well, we didn't know. I'd worried about him from the day he was born, which sounds stupid because he was the best baby. He was so good and he was, you'd have sworn he was smiling almost from the day he was born. But I was worried because he never cried. I never heard him cry. And he never cried. And I went to the doctor and the consultants told me I was a fussy mother. And I wasn't. He had a heart problem. Part of his heart apparently had not formed. He just went blue on me one day. He was in the pram and we rushed to Belfast to a consultant, but there was nothing they could do. So,
did you find that almost impossible to deal with or
yes
not?
Yes and no. Mm. I had a little girl that I was totally responsible for and she was very attached to this little boy and this baby. And she was only a two-year-old, but a very smart two-year-old. And she was devastated because I didn't bring him home from the hospital. Mm. And that was difficult enough. But Sean took it really, really hard. And it was tough. It was a tough time. So,
to the extent that he just took a long time to deal with it? Or
it took
maybe
a long
never...
time. It took a long time to smile again. And he's a very smiley person. Mm. And then I tried to get him to really focus on daughter, which he did. Mm. And he absolutely adored her and she him. And that helped, but it was hard. It was tough.
You feel it's important to deal with grief,
yes,
but move on from grief.
I think you have to. It's I live on the idea that he was a gift that we just had for a short time, and I loved every minute of that short time, and it wasn't our will that happened, but that's what did happen. It tried us both out, but it made us much stronger for each other as well. Not that that was hard, because we have always had a wonderful relationship. But I found it hard. I found it very hard for Sean, and I wished I could take his hurt away. And it was very difficult. It took a long time.
Did you have other children after them?
No, I was pregnant twice again, but it didn't happen. So it was, that was life.
But you have your precious daughter.
Oh, yes.
And she has a daughter.
Yes, who's the light of my life, Indy Abrahams, as she calls
herself. What a great name.
Well, she's just finished her first year in university. She's far too young for that. But she's a super kid. She really is.
Yeah.
You've been fairly blessed in life, haven't you, Ronnie? I mean, most lives, they always say, get its fair share of grief within it. But by and large, you've been very lucky in your life.
Yeah, I thank God every day. I'm very happy in marriage with Joan, wonderful children, endless
She's
grandchildren.
She's very happy with
We've 15 grandchildren. And I empathise with Maeve so much on the sadness of losing your son, because I've had the joy of all my grandchildren. One of ours, little Johnny, didn't make it either, so I can understand that, the emotion of it. And Maeve, you talk so beautifully of these moments and so generously of yourself. And, I think the beauty of a child like that not making it is that you get some other blessing out of it. We as a family, you mentioned your relationship with Sean, which is great anyway. But we as a family, we're much closer because we lost a little grandchild. Mm,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of kind of looking at the positive.
Yeah, but I've been blessed all my life at good success in business. I love expressing myself and I enjoyed sport. I gave up when I was 26 because there was no money in the sport, and I went on and built a career for myself. But then I played sport and I sort of believe in this sort of quality aspect of life that you get from, not from training as much as from participation. Yeah. So I'm a great advocate of get out there and get some exercise and look after yourself. And
well, you're both an advert. I mean, you don't care. You're 84, aren't you, Maeve? Yep. And you're 77.
I'm 77.
Almost 85.
Well, you're sitting in front of me and like you're an ad for sport. I feel I should get out and start running.
We're not quite saying that. We're saying
no, but it's true. But obviously it keeps your mind active.
I think you learn a lot from sport because you learn how to deal with failure as well as success. It's not just about winning. It's about being the best you can be on the day and running the best race you can, because there's a lot of intelligence takes part in a race too, especially middle distance. You don't just go out and blast it. You've got to think about it. And thinking about something when you're physically active is actually quite hard at times. Yeah. You have to be able to think your way through two laps or almost four laps, depending whether it's 8 or 15, as to how it's going and also how the other people around you are running. And who do you have a plan beforehand, and then who do you go with, or do you stay where you are? Do you stick to your own plan? And it's a really tough one, I think.
Mm-hmm. Listen, we're going to take a break, so join us in a few moments.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Follow the programme on Twitter at Miriam Meets.
Welcome back. I'm here this morning with Olympians Ronnie Delaney and Maeve Kyle. We're going to take another piece of music now, Maeve, and it's dedicated to your husband, Sean. Where did you originally meet?
I met him in Hall's Hotel in Antrim on a party organised by Betty Kyle, Jack's sister, who was one of my best friends. And I had to choose a name off a list. And I said, oh, give me the fellow with the Irish name. I didn't know any of them. So I got him, still have him.
And when you chose his name, was that to sit beside, or why were you choosing his name?
Because we were going to a dance. You had to have a partner. You couldn't just go. I mean, nice girls didn't do that. No, we weren't very nice girls, but you still couldn't do it. You had to know who you were going with. Mm-hmm. We conducted the most beautiful courtship over the telephone. I was in Dublin, he was in Ballymena, and he used to ring me nearly every night, or if he didn't ring me, I would ring him. So that was the way, and we only met about three or four times before we were married.
Was he your trainer and your manager?
Yes, he was my sweetheart, my husband, and he, very much so. But when he was, he was my coach, and he saw that I had talent, which I probably didn't realise that I had the talent I had, even because I'd never had the opportunity. I tease him sometimes and tell him you only wanted to marry me because I was an athlete, you see. And he said, you weren't an athlete when I met you. So,
How many years do you know him?
59 years in February.
So what is the secret to your very long and happy courtship?
We each have interests, which we are separate interests. I love the radio. He loves the television. And we both love dogs. We have a Labradoodle. We both love a lot of things together. I adore the garden, but Sean doesn't like gardening. So they're things we don't... It's not we disagree on them. We just get on and do our own thing.
So what's the song you dedicated to him?
The song I was playing in the dance we went to that night was Some Enchanted Evening. And apparently he always says, well, you walked in the door and they were playing that. What could I do about it? And that was it.
Great. We're going to listen now to Frank Sinatra's version of Some Enchanted Evening. Some Enchanted Evening, your choice there, Maeve, dedicated to your husband, Sean. I like the story, Ronnie, about Eamon de Valera's letter to you, congratulating you on your winning gold. What was it he said in that letter,
Ronnie? I think he talked about a Matt Donovan, if I'm correct, and he was a ploughman and he could plough a furrow straighter than anyone else. And he said, like Matt Donovan, you've brought great honour to your village. You know, in other words, the comparable achievement was this guy could plough a furrow dead straight and I brought this great honour to Ireland.
And there's a link with Dev in your family. Your grandfather was appointed to the Senate, was he, in the University
Yes, when, I'm not sure of the year, 1923 or 24, I think, that Dev or the government as it was then, the provisional government, I think it was called, they decided they needed a representative from the universities. And Dev and my grandfather apparently played chess. My grandfather was a grandmaster in chess, and I think Dev had some similar level of ability.
What was your grandfather's name?
Thrift. William Thrift.
And what did he do?
In the university.
He was the provost.
He was the provost in Trinity.
Oh, incredible.
And
quite posh, mate.
He was an absolute... He was a Yorkshireman. That side of my family was from York. He came over here. His father was appointed as one of the high hegians in the Inland Revenue to sort out Ireland, I think. But he was a great chess player. He was an absolutely brilliant academic as well. But I lived with them for a couple of years.
When you were going, is this a myth now, Maeve? Because I read somewhere that you used to go to school in Alexandra College from their home at Trinity and you'd have a butler walking in front of you.
No, not in front of me, beside me.
Oh, beside
She's not telling the truth behind her.
No.
What was he wearing?
Full morning dress. Smyton was the butler in the house. We lived in number 1 Grafton Street, which is a wonderful address. That was the provost's house. And Alexandra at that time was on Earlsford Terrace, just facing what was UCD. And my grandmother would not have trusted me to go on my own. So every morning, once I learnt the way up Grafton Street through Stephen's Green, we had the identical conversation every morning for 2 years. Smyton, I know the way up the terrace. You can leave me here. And he would say, no, Miss Maeve, I'll take you to the door.
Did you get a butler taking you to school, Ronnie?
No, but I also have emotional attachments to the Dublin, because my mummy was Bridget Hughes. My grandfather, Joe Hughes, was the publican, and O'Brien's pub there on 8 mm-hmm. Sussex Terrace. And every time I go by there, I can picture my mother as a little girl wheeling her pram along by the canal or over Leeson Street Bridge. So I have my lovely and recollections of Dublin too. And Maeve, the beauty of living 1 Grafton Street. No, now that was seriously.
I had no idea it was an important address.
Because you're Church of Ireland, aren't
yes.
you, Maeve? Were you conscious growing up that you were, say, different to Ronnie?
No. We were in sport together.
Earlier in the programme, before we went on there, I had to turn to Maeve and I said, what religion were you? Because, I mean, in sport, you don't colour religion. It's not an issue.
No. But also, I was very lucky in that I was brought up in Kilkenny by parents who were most wonderful people, both very serious academics, but marvellous parents. There were 3 of us under 2.5. There was 1 pram. Teachers weren't paid particularly well in those days, and we lived in the boys' school. So once the second one came along, I had to get out of the pram. So I was walking at about a year, and when I was about 2, my father took me for a walk every day, and we discussed the most. Now that I realise, I thought it was great. I learnt about the stars. I learnt about all sorts of things as a very, very small child.
But then you ended up going to live in Ballymena.
I had.
That's when you met Sean.
Well, Sean, that's his hometown. And I was marrying somebody, and I'd always been brought up that you went where your husband was. And he was by that time, was running the family business of insurance broking. And I was so madly, passionately in love with him, I'd have gone anywhere with him. It didn't actually matter. But I found that this was a world that I really didn't know. I had never experienced anything quite as conservative as a provincial town in the north. And Ballymena was particularly conservative. Very, very good people, wonderful people. But as recently as a few months ago, an old farmer out the country where Sean was doing some little job asked him, he's still married to that wee foreign woman? And he says, yeah, for the last 50 plus years.
So, I love that line.
You are with them, but not of them. I found the one thing in Ballymena, to be successful was probably the only thing that actually counted. And it didn't matter what you were successful in, as long as you did as well as you could. And therefore, I was acceptable on that term, but I had to be very aware I'd never be a Ballymena woman.
Are you both very interested in the Olympics being in London?
Of course. I mean, it's a home Olympics, but the delightful thing and the symbolic thing, having talked about Ballymena and the north and the south, the symbolism of the torch coming into south of Ireland into Dublin, where it was run along the streets and I had the pleasure of carrying it, is that it symbolises the new Ireland. And sport transcends politics most of the time. It is political. Absolutely. And this gesture of London, the London Olympic Committee and Seb Coe, Lord Coe in particular, and our achievement of our president, Pat Hickey, in getting the torch into the Republic of Ireland was just
fantastic.
Magnificent. And the love of the Olympics came out on the streets. I sensed it. The public loved the torch being carried along the streets of Dublin.
Do you worry about the purity, though, of the Games when you were both in it is no longer there? I mean, there have been lots of drug scandals over the years.
Yeah, but they involve a very small percentage of the people who are in the Olympics. For me, the Games, the Olympic Games, give every country in the world who's a member of the Olympic Council the opportunity to send their best young people to meet, to compete with and to be part of the best in the world. And nobody can take that away. Ronnie was the one that said one time, once an Olympian, always an Olympian. And if you can remember that, I think it's it really sums it all up.
Yeah, but and that gives us an opportunity collectively to say good luck Team Ireland.
Absolutely.
Do well in London, bring home the gold. And Katie Taylor is a particularly talented and gold medal prospect, so we wish her well.
But I don't know about you, Ronnie, but the Olympics changed my life in one sense of the word, that although I was teaching at the time that I went out to Melbourne, I realised then that I had the opportunity to become a coach and help other young people to have the same experience, because to me it really was a life-changing experience. And I didn't win anything or do anything, but it wasn't that. I still get letters and cards from the girl who was beside me in the first heat of the Olympic Games in Melbourne, Olga Modrichova from Czechoslovakia, and she and I still correspond.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
That's a lovely story. Yeah. Eamon Coughlin came out recently and said that he thought Michelle Smith was Ireland's best ever Olympian. What do you think of that?
I think Eamon's opinion is his opinion. I thought he might have considered me as a reasonable Olympian as well.
Do you have a view on it?
Yeah, well, yes. I always have to. I'm one of these people that always has to have. I'm a Libran, so I always have to balance it. And I'm sorry there was all the whatever it was, the occasion in which Michelle was damned by half the population and mystified the other half, I think, as to what actually happened. I was always concerned that somebody needed to be punished, if you like, for the misbehaviour of an awful lot of other athletes. I don't know whether Michelle took anything or not. I'd like to think she didn't. But she certainly was never found guilty of taking drugs. She was found guilty of tampering with a sample. Now, why you'd want to tamper with a sample, that's, I'm not in a position to say that. But I just always felt very sorry for the fact that she had one, had done so well in the swimming pool. And Ronnie and I would both know she was coached as a track and field athlete, not as a swimmer, for the games in which she did particularly well. And I'd love to know how much difference that made to her swimming ability. I don't know.
As we close today, what strikes me about you both is neither of you quite clearly believe in retirement.
No, absolutely. I don't know what retirement is. Nobody taught me how to behave when I was 80, so I don't bother. But I love being with young people. So I go to the club twice a week. I was coaching hurdles the other night. Found it a bit difficult to demonstrate, a little more difficult.
But did you try?
I did, yeah.
Good woman.
And, I love working with young people, and I would use sport as a medium for helping young people to understand you can't always win, but if you do your best, nobody can blame you.
You don't believe in retiring either, Ronnie, do you?
No, well, I can't afford to. I'm an amateur athlete. I can't afford to. No, I love working. I still work full time. And I enjoy work, and I enjoy, I suppose, keeping my mind active as well as my body.
Well, we're going to finish this morning in a piece of music from Tony Bennett, San Francisco. I think your choice, is it, Ronnie?
Yeah, I'd love, and this brings Maeve and I close together again, because before going down to Australia, we trained for a week in San Francisco, and there was a marvellous man called Brutus Hamilton in the University of Berkeley. Mm-hmm. But we trained in his arena, and this wonderful man, he took us to his home, and his home had little birds and beautiful flowers, and it was a wonderful
gorgeous
week
place.
And if I just
absolutely
might say, there's a man who's with us too called Summers Payne, and if he's listening and he's not that well, he's an Olympian with us, a sailor, and I'd like to say, and I'm sure Maeve would like to join with me, Summers, hope you're okay.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, look, it's been my pleasure to have you both this morning. We're all very proud of you. We're going to go out listening to Tony Bennett, San Francisco, for you both. My thanks on sound today to Kieran Cullen, to my producer, Yeti Redmond. We'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, thank you very much for listening.